Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning yet again. I'm Marty Goldenson, in for Brian Lehrer. As if the responsibilities of parenthood weren't enough for adoptive parents in this age of greater openness, you add a whole other layer. How much information and contact with your children's genetic parents do you owe your child? Do you owe the birth mother? In two separate articles, two mothers who adopted daughters in Guatemala have written about the opening of international adoptions and the questions that are raised for both parents and children. Both writers join me now. Maggie Jones wrote the article Looking for Their Children's Birth Mothers in, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, Sunday's New York Times Magazine. And Elizabeth Larson wrote Did I Steal My Daughter? The Tribulations of Global Adoption for the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Welcome to WNYC, Maggie and Elizabeth.
Good morning, Marty. Good morning, thanks.
Yes, you're nice to come on. Let me start with you, Maggie. What do you think, we'll start with the general, I think, you know, which is what do you think motivates most adoptive parents to try and establish contact with the children's birth parents?
I think some of this comes from what we know about domestic adoption and what we've come to know about domestic adoption in terms of, you know, there have been about 20 years of longitudinal studies showing that openness is psychologically beneficial for adoptees, for adoptive parents, and for birth parents. And I think there's another component to it of, you know, wanting basic questions answered for your child, whether it's medical history or if you were adopting from a country where you don't have photographs of a birth mother or birth father. And it varies really by parent and family, but for some people, they just want some information. For others, they want to have an ongoing relationship so that that birth family can be sort of a natural part of their adopted child's life.
I know there's a sensitivity around the terminology of adoption. Are a birth parent and adoptive parent acceptable, or have we moved on from that?
Well, there's less controversy around adoptive parents, at least, you know, when we're talking in the realm of this. I think if we're just talking about it in another context, we would just say parents. In terms of birth parents and birth mother, there no one is in universal agreement about it. There are different terms. There's first mother, birth mother, biological mother. So I refer in my story often, I use a couple different terms. Birth mother is generally widely used, but not everybody likes it.
Right. And Guatemalan mother?
Elizabeth and I both use that term in our story. I mean, it's, you know, I do feel that my daughter has a mother in Guatemala. I think sort of in my day-to-day language, I use birth mother more often, but I'm comfortable, as a parent, I'm comfortable with all of them.
Elizabeth, let me bring you in on this, and to remind people, I'm Marty Goldenson in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm talking with, you just heard from Maggie Jones, who wrote this article about international adoption in the New York Times Magazine. Now, to draw in Elizabeth Larson, and, you know, that's a provocative title of your article, or partial title, Did I Steal My Daughter? Is that a fear that lies at the heart of international adoption, do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, that editors really like catchy titles, especially titles that are relevant to the news cycle. And if you look at online conversations, I think you'll see, especially in relationship to Guatemala right now, more parents are interested in searching to verify the facts of their adoptions. But the emphasis of my story, I think, is more emblematic of the reasons that I believe parents search in any country. And those are a lot of the reasons that Maggie already has gone over. People want their children to have access to the genetic and cultural information. And I want to add that I think that in a perfect world, that would be something that the person who is adopted would be able to decide for themselves. And I also think that adoptive parents have a deep desire for their children's birth families or first families or Guatemalan families to know that their children are deeply loved.
Tell me a little bit of your story about, you know, how you found this child and going there to meet up and pick up the, and how that worked and how it felt for you?
You mean the adoption itself?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think like the vast majority of American parents who adopt internationally, my husband and I, the primary piece of research that we did was we did our homework on choosing a reputable agency. And after we did that, I did kind of exactly what I did after I chose a midwife when I gave birth for the first time. As I sort of said, you guys know a little bit more about this than I do. I'm kind of in your hands. You tell me what to do. So we went through the process of deciding whether or not we should adopt domestically or internationally, and our social worker thought that we should adopt internationally, and we started out in a program for Colombia, and as happens often in international adoptions, things change with different programs, and when we were no longer eligible to adopt from Colombia, there was a Guatemalan program in this agency, and so we went with that.
Right, right. And you had confidence when you say a reputable agency, but were you worried about other layers there that because it's done privately by lawyers or because just the difference in you know, rich versus poor, us versus them, that in some way it is not, you know, free choice when those mothers, you know, give up their kids?
Those weren't issues, quite honestly, that I was thinking about a lot in the beginning of the adoption process. I wouldn't mm-hmm. say that I had that level of education about what adoption in an international context entails. Mm-hmm. I think that after my adoption was complete and I had some time to reflect on it, I thought more closely about some of the larger issues and about whether or not my daughter's Guatemalan mother did indeed have a choice. And I don't use the word choice in an international context, because usually, certainly not always, and I would never want to generalize, but usually women in what people in the adoption world call sending countries are buckling under some form of oppression, either grinding poverty or lack of access to abortion or birth control or a stigma against single motherhood.
Hmm. I mean, in some ways you're working against oppression, and Maggie or Elizabeth, you know, respond to this notion that you're giving kids a chance that they wouldn't have, and, you know, supporting kids who in some ways are victims of oppression.
I'll just say that, and I'm going to take a guess that Elizabeth might agree with this, that in an ideal world, those children would stay in their country. I think, you know, that is what ideally should happen. Children should grow up with their biological parents whenever possible, and when that's not possible, whether it's, you know, extended family or other families, using Guatemala as an example, other families in Guatemala who can adopt, that's not always possible. And so, you know, international adoption does have a place. What it needs more of is, you know, more transparency, more education for parents. I mean, you know, something that I certainly feel strongly about is we can adopt these children internationally and do our best to make sure everything is on the up and up, but it does become a lifelong process of staying connected to that country and that mm-hmm. culture. And I think, you know, I mean, you're following your child's lead too as they get older, but I do think that adoptive parents, particularly when they're adopting internationally and transracially, they do have an extra layer of obligation as parents.
Let me invite our listeners to join us here, because so many in our listenership are going through and have gone through, you know, what you two have gone through. Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do call in if you want to talk about this with our two guests, Elizabeth Larson and Maggie Jones, both writers. What kind of contact do each of you have with your daughter's birth parents? Can we start with, well, Elizabeth?
We have, obviously, Our daughter's birth family lives in Guatemala, and what we do is we exchange letters and photographs several times a year and just keep them updated on how she's doing, and they send information to her.
Right. What's your sense of their reaction? Do they write you letters back?
Yes.
And what do you hear?
I hear that they are very glad that she's doing well, and what I hear most of, the one message that I want to make sure that comes through the most clearly is what the message that they send over and over again is that they really love her.
Hmm. And must be terribly reassured that she's okay.
They are.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that...
But, I you know, it's obviously complicated and... And complicated only in that it's very sad. There's loss on their side as well.
Yes. And I guess that's that balance between, you know, the reassurance that the child that you've given up is fine and having a good life and is well-loved, and that also, and the other side of it, no way to put it in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that Holly McGinnis, who's the policy director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute, she once said something to me that really struck a chord, and she just said that the central paradox about adoption is that it's gain and it's loss. You can't, to have a family, you have to lose a family. And in my child's case, to have an American, to become an American, she had to stop becoming a Guatemalan. And that's not good or bad, that's just what it is. They don't exist without each other.
Maggie, did you want to?
In terms of my personal story, I had used a searcher who was quite experienced in Guatemala and did the search when my daughter was very young, basically because I was trying, what I had hoped for originally was an open adoption from the get-go. And she was unable to, from the information we were able to give her, she was unable to find the birth mother, and what she sort of said to me is she's had a couple of cases like this where she comes across more information later and finds a birth mother. So the door doesn't feel totally closed to me. And one of the things that's really important in our case, and I think in many other parents' cases who've adopted internationally, we have a really lovely relationship with my daughter's foster family and have ever since the adoption. And they are not her, you know, biological connection to Guatemala, but they provide something I can't. And I think that relationship will continue, I hope, for a lifetime. And you know, they are Guatemalan, and they're a lovely family, and they feel like my daughter is part of them. She spent, you know, 5.5 months in their home. And so it's, I would like to have both, and I hope one day that we will, if that's what every party wants, but for now, it's certainly an aspect that's comforting and nice to have.
Mm, yeah. Our number, by the way, is 212-433-9692. Do we go to a break now, by the way? I'm asking my producer. Should we do that? Let's do that and then come back, and I want to address a couple questions, you know, one of which is it healthier to leave the kids in the country they're in and support them there? Marty Goldenson in for Brian Lehrer. We're talking about transnational adoption. Let's go to calls, and so our expert guests, Elizabeth Larson and Maggie Jones, can talk to you. Is it Vinit from Clifton, New Jersey? Are you on the line there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. What's your thinking about this?
Well, you know, my wife and I, we're both American-born people of Indian origin, and we've just started exploring the process for adopting. We both have wanted to do it, and even from, you know, individually before we were married, and we're starting the process and looking into either adopting from India or adopting from China, specifically a daughter. And I kind of take a little bit of issue with what I hear a little bit from one of your guests there, at least, kind of offer a slightly different view on it. I'm not exactly sure I buy into the idea that, you know, in an ideal world, a child would be, you know, it's kind of like meant to be, or would be happier or would be better off in the country that they happen to be born into, or in the particular ethnicity or nationality that they happen to be born into. You know, with us, if we decide to go the route of, for instance, adopting a daughter from China, you know, as a person of faith, which I happen to be, my wife and I are both Hindus, and as a person of faith, you know, to me, I feel like it's just as destined, or it's just as much God's arrangement for that child to maybe be meant to be, you know, our daughter and be brought to America and be raised in an Indian American household, and she can, and we would raise her, and she would grow up with, you know, those Indian American gifts and our culture as best as we could, you know, communicate it to her as best as we could communicate it to any of our children. And if down the line, if she wanted to explore what it means to be an Indian or an American or a Chinese or any other ethnicity, actually, why should it matter that biologically she happens to be, you know, from Chinese parentage biologically?
Elizabeth Larson, why should it matter?
Well, I can only say that what I have heard from adults who are adopted, and mostly from Korea, and what they would say and what they've said to me is that when we grow up in environments that are so interested and preoccupied with DNA, it's hard not to feel some interest in that. And now some people that were adopted don't have an interest in their birth culture or in their birth families, but a large percentage of them do say that they at least would like to have some information about who they are. And I think when you think about going to a doctor's office and you're filling in your medical history and you don't know anything and what you can anything that you can write down, that's something that would be important in terms of having that kind of background information.
We have a caller named Maggie who in a moment can talk with our guest named Maggie. What was your thought?
Hi, are you ready?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, great. Hi. I just wanted to let you know that my daughters, I brought them home from Ukraine a little over 2 years ago, and I was not expecting this, but my daughters were 6 and 9 when they came home. I was anticipating adopting younger children, but the program in Ukraine is challenging, and you are grateful to grab your children and get home. But I wanted to say about, you know, connecting with a birth mother and your birth family. For my 9-year-old, or she is now 11,
mm-hmm.
I know for her and the conversations that we've had about it, I think it would be a very important closure for her emotionally to meet her birth mother, who she received a lot of emotional damage from. And then from my younger daughter, she's very confused and it tries to understand the difference between birth mother and me, and she really wants to see her baby pictures. So it's an interesting kind of combination of needs my daughters have.
Yeah, this tends to remind me, and I think Maggie Jones, you would agree with this, that each country is different in terms of this issue of reconnecting with the birth mother.
Absolutely, and it's the caller's example is a great example because it's not only that each country is different, but each child is different.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a picture really may be enough, particularly at a particular age. Somebody had said to me, an adoption expert had said, you know, sometimes kids at 11 or 12 are saying, I want to meet my birth mother. And in fact, what they really want is they want to know what she looks like. They want to have information on her. They want part of their, you know, chapter one of their life. So I think it's true that it varies by country how much information you can reasonably expect to get, China being the hardest because, you know, babies are anonymously abandoned. And but that it really does vary by child and by the age of the child and by the family. And one of the things that I think is sadly lacking in all of this in terms of searching is that there isn't enough support for parents and for adoptees about, you know, what are you looking for and what can you expect to find and how are you going to deal with it when you find it? Because these stories can be very complicated, and I think too often people are going into it with sort of this, you know, idealized notion of
I'm going to find the mother and everything's gonna, we're all going to be pals,
right? And she's going to be saintly and she's just poor. I mean, people have incredibly complicated lives, and
sure,
that, you know, plays a part in relinquishing your biological child. That's not a simple thing to do. So some people have just lovely relationships, and some people have very complicated relationships after they've searched.
Of course, of course. I want to bring in Jennifer on the line from Port Washington. I've already been listening to, is this one of your two girls I'm hearing in the background?
Yes, it is.
Yes, good. How old are they?
Almost 4 and 2.5.
And from China?
Yes,
Rachel?
Both.
Yeah. So have you tried to contact the birth mother, or what do you have there?
Well, there really isn't any way to do that. Children in China are legally abandoned. I mean, there's no process for a parent to give up a child. They have to be abandoned. That's it. But what we have done in our, when we went to adopt our second daughter, was we visited our first daughter's finding spot and tried to get as much information, and we did find an interesting tidbit that it turned out to be right across the street from a maternity hospital, so that might be a starting point.
Mm-hmm. Why do you feel impelled to look? Tell me about that.
I'm sorry.
You feel impelled to look.
Yeah.
Right, and you have the DNA sample. Right. Why? Tell me about that impulse.
Well, because of the one-child policy, it's, I mean, people have occasionally tracked down birth parents in China, but it's rare. But times may change. By the time they're 30 or 40 years old, that may be something that can be done. There may be when possibly their birth parents are feeling their own mortality, they may tell their siblings, because they probably have siblings in
yes.
China.
Yes. Yeah, Maggie or Elizabeth, did you have some thoughts about China in particular?
I know that some adoption experts that I've spoken with said, you know, point to the fact that China is a rapidly changing society. And 20 years ago, no one thought that people who were adopted from Korea would search and be able to be reunited with their first families, and that. In China, no one knows what the future holds for China, and that attitudes may change, and DNA matches will be the key to that, if in fact there is a rethinking of that.
Hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask about, and thank you for calling, is this business of when you recontact the parents, the birth parents, can it be dangerous? I mean, a lot of kids, you know, are born out of wedlock, or to there's shame, there's infidelity. This could be dangerous, could it not?
For the birth
mother. Parents, yeah.
Yes.
You just have to have some, you know, Westerner, you know, doing research in some country.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and it's very, very important that, you know, searchers run the gamut in terms of how they operate. And, I mean, one of the most important things for both adult adoptees and for adoptive parents in thinking about searching is to choose carefully, and you want somebody who is culturally very, very sensitive, as my searcher was in Guatemala. And I mean, I interviewed searchers in a few different countries who have not run into problems in terms of the adoption agencies often tell parents, you know, don't search, and this is one of the reasons why. You can put the birth mother at risk. I think it's a valid concern. The searchers with the best reputations tend to not have many of those problems, because they are very careful and they only speak directly to the birth mother. They do not send letters. They don't make phone calls and leave a message with, you know, a husband who truly may not know anything about this. And there have been some cases where in former Soviet bloc countries, a couple of cases where, you know, a searcher sent a letter and lo and behold, the wrong person opened the letter, and one birth mother was beaten up by her husband, and another was thrown out of the house by her parents. So, you know, it's not something that parents, frankly, at least from my experience in talking to searchers in the various countries, can go about doing on their own, go knocking on doors. As you say, you know, you don't want a U.S., you know, adoptive mom coming to your doorstep. It definitely raises some red flags.
Yes. You know, Can we bring in on the line Brendan from Manhattan, who I think has experienced some of this firsthand? What was the story when you did your or wanted to have a search, Brendan?
Hi, I was adopted in Ireland. It wasn't an international adoption, but when I was in
Ireland, did you say Ireland?
Yes.
Yeah.
So when I was in my early 20s, I had the curiosity of finding out who my mother might be. And in Ireland, the adoption laws are very secretive and it's very controlled. So I had to go through an agency and I got in touch with my mother. She didn't really want me to have anything to do with her. And subsequently, I found out I had a genetic disorder. And I tried to contact the agency again to say that she sent me a picture with her family and children and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to highlight the fact that this genetic disorder, which is kind of benign but could have long-term consequences if not taken care of, to put that in the file or at least to get someone to know that, but to no avail. So it was a little bit of a disappointment, and I wasn't trying to disrupt her life.
In fact, to help her life.
Yes, and our children, because it's an iron absorption. It's hemochromatosis, so you don't get diagnosed with it until the damage is done, and usually in your 40s and 50s. And it was...
Let me break in for a second. Did you feel rejected? Was it awful? Did you have your hopes up?
Well, in the extreme sense, I suppose you have the second rejection of one being given up, and then when you try and contact you, rejected again. But in reality, I obviously understood she had her own life and was not maybe prepared to have this disruption or a new person introduced to her family. It was just a little bit bizarre that she sent me a couple of pictures that were just... But that was the only contact.
Right. Well, there is the nature of pain and understanding. It hurt, you know, and yet you understood it.
Yes, of course. And, you know, I had a very good adopted life, so I would not have traded that. And
sure.
You know, so you just move on and say that's my history.
Yes. Thank you very much for calling in, Brendan.
Okay. You're welcome. Good show.
Thanks. Good show means many things. Back to Elizabeth Larson and Maggie Jones, who are both writers, both international adoptive parents. Here's the sort of question I've been, you know, skirting around a little bit, but how prevalent do you think, from your own research, both of you, is outright theft of children for adoption? Do we know, even, and am I right that adoptions in Cambodia were shut down because of widespread corruption? Elizabeth, are you on top of this?
You know, I am not on top of it on a global scale. And the truth is that we don't have definitive numbers about incidences of corruption. I can only speak a little bit about Guatemala, and I am not an expert in the circumstances. And the Guatemalan situation right now is very volatile and changes every day. But I can say that in the past year, every adoption expert that I've interviewed has said very strongly that they felt that there was need for reform. Now, but there are no hard numbers about outright theft. I have met and interviewed families who this has impacted. So, I mean, I certainly know that it happens.
Maggie Jones, writing for the New York Times Magazine about this general subject, did you get any sense of that?
I think, the numbers are incredibly hard to pin down because some parents know that it's happened and some parents don't know that it's happened. And I think, you know, when we talk about Cambodia or Guatemala, they're not alone in being having problems in terms of ethical problems of that range from, you know, our birth mothers being paid something to the extreme of outright theft. Certainly I had interviewed somebody for my story who adopted two girls from India, and the girls were older and came home saying we were stolen from our mother, and it took them a while to get, the agency wasn't really responding, and they got a searcher to finally search for them, but it took a while, and the mother confirmed the story and the searcher confirmed the story. I think, you know, it's one of those cases, one is too many, and I think it's a real, not just Guatemala, not just Cambodia, not just Vietnam, not just India,
there's adoption reform needed across the board, and there's a great need for greater transparency. It is one of the things that searching can sometimes do, and it can be an important reason to search if you think that there's a biological mother out there who did not voluntarily relinquish her child. But searching shouldn't be, you know, the answer to that. It really should be about wholesale adoption reform.
Yes, yes.
And again, the more openness in the beginning of the adoption would prevent...
Yes, that mystery from happening. Right. Yeah, yeah. Let me bring in Judy from, is it Goshen, New York, Judy?
Yes, Goshen,
yeah.
New York.
You wanted to know what the status of the Guatemalan adoptions are right now?
Well, my girlfriend is in the process of adopting. It's been about a year since she started the paperwork. She did receive word that there was a lovely little girl waiting for her. It's been about 7 months. She's only had very, very little contact, no actual letters, just a few pictures of the child. And I was just wondering if that was a typical, the typical process. They told her about 7 months. It is 7 months this month, and you know, no letters or anything or official paperwork.
Hmm. Either of you know what the situation is in Guatemala right now?
As Elizabeth said, volatile. When you say no official paperwork, what do you mean? No medical records, nothing?
You know, physical testing, the blood work, the DNA, all of that. She filled out the paperwork. Obviously, it was accepted. And when she received the initial pictures of this baby, there maybe have been one or two other envelopes with just a few pictures, but not an official letter, you know, from the agency or any other paperwork. Supposedly, this is the child she's going to receive and be able to adopt, you know, in 6 or 7 months. This is the 7 months. And I was just wondering, is that like a typical... you know, is this typical in your experience or knowledge?
Well, in terms of the time frame changes greatly. I mean, things have been much slower in Guatemala, for instance, than when I adopted from Guatemala. And in terms of the paperwork, I think that, too, varies by agency. Elizabeth may be able to speak better to this. I mean, it is an extremely rocky time to be adopting from Guatemala, and some agencies are no longer making referrals because of how volatile it is. I can just say in my case, I received monthly medical updates on my daughter through the pediatrician in Guatemala and just received sort of email updates from my agency. I'm not sure about the lack of paperwork. I mean, I'm also trying to remember, Elizabeth. You might be able to.
We can't and don't have time, unfortunately, to go into Guatemala in that detail. I just want to end with a final question that I thought maybe both of you could chime in on, which is, I always had thought that parents often adopted internationally simply to avoid, or in part to avoid, the openness of American adoptions. Am I off the mark there?
No, you're not. I think that adoption experts would widely acknowledge that part of the appeal of international adoption can be that the adoptions are closed. Now, that said, I think that that's all changing. I think, and I don't think that adoptive parents want a closed adoption because of bad reasons. I think that this is largely about starting a larger conversation about adoption and about what makes healthy adoptions and what are ethical adoptions, and that's just a conversation that's just beginning to percolate more into the mainstream.
Yeah, we're out of time, but I want to thank both of you for starting that conversation so publicly. Both Maggie Jones, who wrote the New York Times Magazine article looking for their children's birth mothers, and Elizabeth Larson, freelance writer who wrote for Mother Jones' current issue, Did I Steal My Daughter? The Tribulations of Global Adoption. Thanks, both of you.
Thanks for having us.